Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting to order. I'd like to invite Karen Gibson up to the table. And whomever else is going to present on Medicaid eligibility and enrollment. Welcome to the working group, and if you could introduce yourselves for the record, please, and proceed with your presentation. And I would like to ask before you begin if you would like questions as you go forward. It's a longer PowerPoint presentation, so I don't know if you'd like questions as we move through or if you'd like us to hold our questions until the end.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It may be best just to, as we move through, and if you see we're kind of pressed for time, perhaps then we could save them for the end.
All right. Thank you. And members, then, if you have questions, if you just let me know, and we'll work our way through this. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Karen Gibson. I am the Acting Director for the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division at the Department of Human Services. With me is Troy Mangan, the Minnesota Healthcare Connect Manager, and we are pleased to be here today to speak with you on Medicaid eligibility and enrollment and changes in those program rules and processes under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, ACA, which would take effect January 1st, 2014. There are several unknowns, or more than several unknowns, that we do not yet know. I tried to identify those in the slide, and more guidance is forthcoming from the Secretary of Health and Human Services. We've divided the presentation into six sections. Thought it might be easier to kind of break it down that way. We will start by reviewing our current and future Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program CHIP groups. From there, we will review the existing Medicaid financial eligibility and new financial eligibility in 2014 under the ACA. We will provide a brief introduction on the basic health plan and maybe some items for the commission to consider. It's our understanding that that will be the topic of a future meeting. And we will provide some information on application and enrollment simplification requirements in 2014. And compare our existing requirements to the new requirements. We will also kind of review the federal vision for how the exchange and Medicaid is to interact, and then we'll conclude with systems automation and interfaces, including some current DHS processing and systems initiatives that we have. So we'll start, I guess, first with the Medicaid and CHIP groups. So we're on page 2 and slide number 4. The slide numbers are just a very tiny number there at the bottom of each slide. In Minnesota, federal Medicaid and CHIP funds help finance medical assistance and our Minnesota Care programs. I do just want to note that we do have some non-federally funded groups on those programs. So this is going to be focused just on our federally funded groups. To be eligible for Medicaid, an individual needs to be a member of a group. Our existing groups are identified on this slide: infants ages 0 to 2, children ages 2 to 21, pregnant women, parents, elderly and disabled, and we also have a spend down group for people who exceed the income limit. The income limit that is listed generally is the Minnesota Care limit, which is usually higher than our medical assistance income limit. Starting in 2014, we have a mandatory Medicaid expansion, two actually. One is an adult expansion, where the income limit will go up to 133% of federal poverty guidelines, or FPG. And the second is for children ages 18 to 26 who are aging out of foster care, and there is no income limit for that group. There's also the option to expand upon that adult expansion group and take that income limit up to 275% FPG at the state's option. So we can exceed that up to our highest MA income limit, but we do have to have comparable eligibility for children as well. So thus, we could go up to 275 if we desired. I will perhaps note that there are two spend-down standards listed under the existing for the families and children groups, infants, children, pregnant women, parents, if they are above the income limit, they can spend down to 100% FPG. The elderly and disabled spend down to 75% of federal poverty guidelines. The next slide, slide five, just is included as a reference, point of reference, and shows annual income limits for various family sizes at different FPG levels. On slide six, we will be able to receive an enhanced federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP, for the Medicaid expansion group. And the FMAP represents the amount of federal funding that we can receive. Generally, Minnesota receives a 50% federal match, but temporarily under the ARRA, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, we are receiving a higher FMAP rate. There are two possible scenarios we have identified or laid out here. The highest possible FMAP, that column, we would be able to receive FMAP at 100% for 3 years, decreasing in 2017 to 95% FMAP, and then leveling up to 90% by 2010. Under that scenario, all newly eligible adults qualify, so that would include adults without children, parents with excess income or excess assets or income for medical assistance, or parents barred from Minnesota care coverage because of employer-subsidized insurance. The disabled with excess assets or income between 100 to 133% of federal poverty guidelines could also qualify. For those not newly eligible, we would still get our regular FMAP rate. Under the lowest possible FMAP scenario, we would start at 75% FMAP in 2014. It would gradually increase to 90% by 2020. Only adults without children would qualify for that, and they would not need to be newly eligible. Under that scenario, we'd get regular FMAP for parents and disabled with income between 100 and 133% FPG. We laid these out because I think what's at issue for us is whether we would be considered to be an expansion state, a state that has already extended eligibility to adults with income to 100% FPG or above. So that's the two scenarios. Some administrative changes on slide seven related to that FMAP are identified. We will need to uniquely identify the adult Medicaid expansion enrollees eligible for the higher FMAP. Under the most favorable outcome, we would have to identify five separate groups: newly eligible adults without children, newly eligible parents, not newly eligible parents, newly eligible disabled, and not newly eligible disabled. Even for the least favorable outcome, we still have to identify that tracking and separate that out, because for the first time in the Medicaid program, there would be a different FMAP rate for different groups.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gibson, but that's only to figure out what we think we will have for financing. It doesn't have anything to do with how the program would operate. We wouldn't be operating a program with five different categories under the new rules for health care.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, that's Gibson. Correct. It's more of an internal tracking procedure that would need to be done so that we obtain the correct FMAP amount for each group.
Right, and so it doesn't really have anything to do with determining eligibility or what benefits people get or what the criteria is for their eligibility.
Madam Chair, Senator Ms. Gibson. That is correct. It really is more of just the financing. You're correct.
Please proceed.
Okay. Moving into the financial eligibility section, slide nine. For our different groups, there are different income methods and different asset tests that are applied. Under the medical assistance program, there is an individual net income test and, in some cases, an asset test. Under Minnesota Care, there is a gross household income test and, again, for certain groups, an asset test. Generally, when workers are determining eligibility, they are starting with gross household, or they're starting with gross income and trying to make the determination of what is the gross income. And also at that same time, they're determining whose income is going to be counted for who. Once those determinations are made, they then are looking at what income is considered to be unavailable or excluded and would not be counted as part of the income that is counted, and comparing the ultimate amount then in terms of Minnesota CARE, the gross household income, to the appropriate income standard to determine if there is eligibility. For medical assistance, there are some income disregards and deductions that are permitted. So after a determination of is made of what is the gross income, whose income has to count for this individual, what's unavailable, what's excluded, they will then apply appropriate income disregards and deductions, which vary by the different groups. If the person's income does not exceed the income limit, they will be eligible. If it exceeds the income limit, they may still be eligible for MA on a spend-down basis. I won't speak too much about MA payment for long-term care services other than to say that there are some additional conditions and asset rules that apply for people who need long-term care services. Slide number 10 shows some of the new financial eligibility starting in 2014 under ACA. For certain populations, there will be a new income method used, which is the Modified Adjusted Gross Income, or MAGI, which is adjusted gross income plus tax-exempt interest and certain foreign earned income. MAGI and household income is based on the IRS code, and the section is cited there, and there would be no asset test. I might note that MAGI also applies to the exchange subsidies. On slide 11, we've indicated who the new eligibility rules, financial eligibility rules, apply to. They are pregnant women and infants, children, parents, and the adult expansion group. And MAGI would apply to all of our federally funded groups, both on MA and Minnesota CARE.
Ms. Gibson?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you can just, from your perspective, share with us a little bit about the implications of what appears to be a more uniform set of standards for eligibility and for payment for the people enrolled in Medicaid.
Madam Chair, having a single methodology actually, I think, will make it easier. It should streamline to some extent the application process versus having the multiple different kinds of income methods that are presently used, which can be confusing both for clients and applicants as well as for workers who are determining eligibility. So it should make the calculation, I think, easier for all involved. We do have a slide coming up which I think will kind of compare those populations and show the differences.
Thank you.
Slide number 12 continues on about some of the new financial eligibility that will be required in 2014. We will be required to have effective income limits where we, our state, would negotiate with the federal agency to convert our current MA income limits and methods to comparable standards with no disregards or deductions for the MAGI populations, pregnant women, infants, children, parents. In addition, children who are determined ineligible for medical assistance due to the conversion to the effective income limits are deemed eligible for CHIP. One point to note is just under Minnesota CARE, there really are no income disregards and deductions there, so we would not expect changes to be occurring to the income limits for that program.
And Ms. Gibson, if I might interrupt again, can you, to the first bullet, can you just elaborate a little bit on what the state would be negotiating regarding the conversion to current MA, conversion of current MA limits?
Right. Madam Chair, those really are focusing on the medical assistance income limits, where currently we have a net income determination we're using. So to convert and get those into a gross household income will be, for example, parents on MA are at 100% FPG currently is our income limit. will have to figure in any deductions or disregards that would apply to that group, and it would effectively raise that income limit in order to get them to a modified adjusted gross income test. So it should set the income limit higher.
Thank you. Ms. O'Connell.
Madam Chair. Ms. Gibson, so to follow up on what Representative Murphy was asking about, is this, again, something that that first bullet, is that, again, something that is important in terms of being able to track people going forward about whether they fit into their groups? You know, which group they fit into from an accounting standpoint? Is that what the importance of that first bullet is?
Madam Chair and members, I don't think it's quite so much a tracking as much as it is converting our existing Medicaid net income methodology into more of a MAGI-type modified adjusted gross income methodology where we aren't having income deductions and disregards and effectively setting that income limit higher. We do some amount of tracking for each of these groups because currently there are different rules that apply to them, but because there will be some streamlining of that and more alignment, that may not be quite as necessary in the future.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Gibson. Is there an option for us to just go to the new MAGI standards and not have to have this effective income limit that really relates back to our past history and kind of start redefining things from a new basis going forward? I mean, I understand there's a transition as you're trying to adjust to this before you can get the computer systems up, but it seems to me there may be some advantages to just kind of creating a new baseline as quickly as we can and moving forward.
Ms. Gibson.
Madam Chair and member, there are some maintenance of effort requirements in the new federal law. We will get to a little bit later in the presentation, and I think part of the issue there is making sure that we aren't violating the maintenance of effort requirements and thus the need to convert.
Senator Bergman.
Madam Chair, I think there's also an issue about paying for any expansion prior to the time we would get additional federal funds to help us pay for it. And there might be an issue with the federal government about kind of streamlining this in a way where you might be claiming they should give you more federal funding and they might think they should be giving you less.
All right, Ms. Gibson, please proceed. And it appears to me that we're going to, you know, go through this, and I'm grateful for people's questions, and then we're probably going to have a roundup of some discussion at the end.
Okay.
Thank you.
Slide number 13 just shows the populations that will not, where the income methodologies and financial eligibility for Medicaid will not be changing, and those include elderly people age 65 and older, people with a disabled basis of eligibility, people in need of long-term care services, people who have a spend down, dual eligibles in the Medicare savings program, so people that are enrolled in both Medicare and Medicaid and are qualifying for one of those Medicare saving programs to help them with their Medicare premiums, copays, and deductibles, and people whose eligibility is based on the receipt of other aid, for example, foster care assistance, or those that are automatically eligible for coverage, such as certain newborns.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglin.
Ms. Gibson, do we know when the federal government is going to give us a definition of what they mean by long-term care services?
Ms. Gibson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglin, no, we do not know. We don't know exactly when we'll be getting further guidance from HHS on these provisions.
Do we think it will be sooner rather than later?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglin, we really aren't getting indications on when any further guidance will be forthcoming around the Medicaid provisions, unfortunately.
All right, please proceed.
Slide 14 That slide compares existing income methods and the asset test to the new financial eligibility requirements in 2014. For the first seven groups, which is our MA family kids populations and our Minnesota Care family kids populations, the existing income method will change from what it is today to the MAGI, the Modified Adjusted Gross Income, and none of those groups we will have an asset test come 2014. And again, anybody who does exceed that income limit can still qualify for MA on a spend down basis. Slide 15, there are some items, you know, some issues that we do not know regarding the new financial eligibility. The IRS definition of MAGI does not align, at least with current Medicaid rules, regarding household composition, sources of countable income, and point in time requirements. For example, with household composition, our program is currently based on marital and parental relationships and who resides together. And this may not necessarily be how people file their tax returns. So, for example, in Minnesota Care, an unmarried couple with a mutual child, we would consider a household, and we would look at that couple's income. However, in terms of a tax return, they could be filing separate tax returns. Some sources of income that are counted for Medicaid are not necessarily included on a tax return, such as child support. And point-in-time requirement refers to, for Medicaid, we are getting someone's current income information and using that to project their income for a six-month, or in the case of Minnesota Care, a one-year period of time, with the exception of the retro period in medical assistance where we're using actual income. So the tax return might be a little bit old and not reflect current circumstances for a client. It is also not clear how we will determine eligibility for households or individuals who do not file tax returns, the separate filers, as I mentioned, and households with frequent or recent income changes. Slide 16, there are a few more unknowns there as well. It isn't clear how financial eligibility will be determined for those populations that will be using MAGI who need MA payment for long-term care services, and how eligibility might be determined for combination households, meaning household members are composed of both exchange and MA or MAGI members, or exchange MAGI and MA long-term care household members. So some of those combinations, it isn't quite clear how that might work. On slide 17, we referenced briefly the maintenance of effort requirements under federal reform. The ACA conditions federal Medicaid payments on compliance with certain maintenance of effort requirements. The state may not adopt more restrictive Medicaid and CHIP eligibility rules, procedures, and processes than were in effect on the date of enactment of the law, which was March 23, 2010. The MOE for adult populations ends in 2014, or when the exchange is fully operational. And for kids, for children, the MOE would continue using the MAGI with the corresponding effective income limit until October 2019. The MOE applies to federally funded groups also in Minnesota Care. Of course, it does not apply to any of our state-funded groups in Minnesota Care or GANC. There is no maintenance of effort for newly eligible adults in the Medicaid Adult Expansion Group. And there is a provision that if a state can be exempt from MOE requirements for non-disabled adults with income above 133% FPG starting in 2011, if the state certifies that it is experiencing a budget deficit or will experience a deficit in the following year. Moving on to slide 18, we'll just do a very brief introduction around a non-Medicaid state option that I believe the commission will be taking up further in the future, but it is the basic health plan. So on slide 19, in lieu of exchange eligibility for individuals with income between 133 and 200% FPG without insurance or access to affordable coverage, there is this option. The plan must provide at least the minimum essential health benefits. Some of those benefits are identified in the law, but there is, I think, guidance expected, but not until the fall, around the essential health benefits. And then on slide 20, some just considerations around the health plan would be exactly what the benefits are for the essential benefit set. There's an unknown risk profile of those eligible with income between 133 and 200% FPG, those that would be current Minnesota Care enrollees, maybe in the individual market, uninsured, or under the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Provider networks and payment rates, of course, would need to be established. And the state would receive 90% of funds that would have been paid as exchange subsidies for premiums and cost sharing, but it is not known what the exchange private market plan premium that the 95% would be based on. So that is an unknown. And as mentioned on the prior slide, for this population, it would eliminate the exchange as an option for coverage for them.
Senator Bergman has a question.
Yes, Ms. Gibson, in regard to bullet number 2, wouldn't it be possible for us to know how many people are between 133 and 200% of poverty in MSHA today?
Ms. Gibson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I myself do not know that, but certainly we could see if that's possible to find out.
You could just contact MSHA to find
yes.
out, I would think.
Yep.
And then in regard to the individual market, isn't it fair to say that the individual market for this income group, again, would be pretty small? The number of individuals within this income bracket within the individual market would be pretty small.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I probably am not intimately familiar with the individual market for this population, but that it is a relatively small income band there, so presumably yes.
And wouldn't it be pretty much true that within the individual market the risk would be not very great because of underwriting that takes place to direct people to MSHA if they have underwriting issues?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I honestly do not know the answer to that, so I can't really comment. You may well be right.
Well, I just think this bullet number 2 shouldn't be that hard to figure out, really. And so I would just throw this back to the department to do more work on this bullet because, you know, the more information we have, the better off we are.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, actually, the remaining part of the presentation, I'll turn to Mr. Mangan to present.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Mangan.
I'm Troy Mangan, and I'm a manager in the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division at DHS. And we're going to switch from some of the policy perspective to looking at some of the systems and process capacity parts of ACA implementation. As we've talked about with the policy aspects, much of this is still subject to further clarification from the Secretary of HHS, but this is our understanding as of this point. The next couple of slides deal with some of the enrollment simplification requirements that are to be scheduled for 2014. The exchange must have a website that informs individuals of eligibility requirements for all state programs, including Medicaid and CHIP, and is capable of screening and enrolling individuals in those programs if eligible. And there needs to be the connection to the public program eligibility process as well as the exchange eligibility and enrollment process. Related to that, then, the state also has to have a website that's linked to the exchange that will allow people who are eligible for both MA or CHIP and premium assistance under the exchange to be able to compare benefits, premiums, and cost sharing. And then in addition to that, the state must ensure that individuals can apply for, be enrolled in, and renew their Medicaid eligibility via the website. So this implies us also having individual accounts so that individuals can go in there and manage their own health care in terms of being able to go in and have some sort of identifier to say, this is who I am if I'm going to be renewing my eligibility. The state must also enroll individuals in Medicaid and CHIP without any further determination if they're determined eligible by the exchange. So this is the idea that if we get information from someone one time through the application process, that if the exchange determines that the person is MA eligible through whatever mechanism they have in place, then we must go and, from a state perspective, enroll them in Medicaid and CHIP. We don't need to ask for additional information. That initial determination should be enough. And the state that must also ensure that people who are determined ineligible for Medicaid or CHIP are screened for eligibility for plans under the exchange and premium and cost-sharing assistance. And this would be a scenario in which, for example, enrollment was not open under the exchange and the person went directly to the state for eligibility. We need to make sure that there's those connections back and forth. So you can see in all these slides there, and we'll talk about it in the next slide, there's a lot of need for data interchange and connection between the exchange and the state. If those, in fact, are separate entities, there's going to be a high level of data interchange between those two. In addition, the state has to coordinate coverage for people who are enrolled in both Medicaid or CHIP and a qualified health plan under the exchange, if that were to happen. Finally, here's kind of the more explicit requirement that the exchange and the Medicaid agency must have electronic interfaces, obviously, to do all the things that we've talked about in the previous slides for purposes of facilitating eligibility enrollment. And then finally, all hospitals that are participating in Medicaid are permitted to be able to make presumptive eligibility determinations for all Medicaid populations. And here again, we're talking about another level of data interchange between those hospitals and the Medicaid agency around eligibility, which is, again, something new that we don't have right now. The next few slides compare our existing enrollment processes to what will be required in 2014. Right now, the first is processing paper applications received by mail, by fax, or in person. We currently have 87 counties and 3 tribal agencies that administer MA. We have 46 counties that also process Minnesota Care applications. And then the state Minnesota Care Operations Unit administers Minnesota Care, but also the Family Planning Program, the Minnesota COBRA subsidy, and a few MA cases. So processing paper applications happens now and will have to happen in the future. Assisting clients with completing those applications or connecting them with someone who can provide that assistance, a function both now and in the future. Allowing clients to apply for and renew coverage online. We just covered that in the last several slides. We're currently working on an online application, and we'll have that rolled out, we hope, July 1 of next year, and that certainly is an important part of the functionality in 2014. And then finally, maintaining a website helps people who are eligible for both the Medicaid exchange to compare benefits, premiums, cost sharing. Obviously, that's not something that we have. We have some capacity now under MinnesotaHelp.info as part of our online application development, where we're starting to have our information on eligibility available in a nicely structured format, and we also have information on the DHS website, but nothing at this level in terms of comparing of those benefits, premiums, and cost sharing. Another important part of enrollment process is the actual processing and eligibility determinations. Right now and in the future, processing entities have to review the application, request additional information and verifications if necessary. They also need to assist the client with obtaining verifications if needed, and those the kinds of verifications that we're collecting now. Pre-eligibility, information on income, assets, social security number, whether they have employer-subsidized insurance. once a person is determined eligible, we look at things like pregnancy, citizenship, immigration status. Another duty right now is processing applications within the required timelines. Right now, our processing times vary depending on the group. 15 days for MA applications for pregnant women, 30 days for Minnesota Care, 60 days for individuals applying for MA and have a disability, and then pretty much 45 days for MA applications for everyone else. You know, obviously entering information into the eligibility system and issuing notice of eligibility now and in the future will be needed. Assisting the client with enrollment and managed care if they desire that is something now that the counties do in terms of their education process and will be something that will need to happen in the future. The remaining functions are things that we see are new, processing functions, and we've discussed some of these in the previous slides. Enrolling individuals in Medicaid or CHIP based on the eligibility determination of the exchange, you know, screening those folks who are ineligible for Medicaid or CHIP for exchange eligibility, coordinating that coverage back and forth between the exchange and Medicaid CHIP, maintaining electronic interface, and then the presumptive eligibility. All those are new functions going forward.
Yes, Ms. Holmgren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Magnin, could you just give an example of what would be an example of coverage, someone who would be eligible for coverage under both Medicaid and a qualified health plan under the exchange?
Ms. Gibson.
Madam Chair, member, it is possible that someone could have Medicaid coverage and in addition be eligible for a plan under the exchange. I don't think I can give you a very good example as of today, but as we have kind of sorted and tried to do some analysis on it, it looks to us like, yes, that someone could be eligible, and so that coverage would need to be coordinated.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Mangan. There's a couple throughout this discussion of sort of a dual system and need for interface between the two systems. And since our Medicaid system is ancient, 96 with an update in the 2000s, I believe, and that there's federal money to develop this new system, can you envision us developing the exchange and its web-based technology at the same time as developing an integrated, as a component of that, eligibility system for the people who are eligible for this, so that there would actually be one integrated system rather than communication between two for these populations that are eligible for the exchange?
Mr. Magnin.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. I think that's probably a key question around this in terms of what is the relationship. When you start talking about data interchanges, certainly the best way to do that is to have it all embedded in one system. Whether we have the capacity within our existing legacy systems in 3 years with unknown business requirements to be able to be ready to take on the exchange functions as well as make the changes to the existing functions for MA and Minnesota Care, it seems like a tall order. As I'll say in some subsequent slides, there's enough changes that we have to do just to our systems to accommodate the things like MAGI, other things like that. I think that's ultimately probably not our call in terms of, you know, how the exchange is going to look going forward, but I think it's as I said, we're 3 years away and still awaiting lots of clarification in terms of what the policy is going to look like. For us to move forward on systems development is going to require much more, much firmer foundation in terms of the policy pieces. So I'm not sure that's a satisfactory answer, but I think it's going to be very, in my opinion, very difficult to be able to do that. It's not very much time.
Well, I know the time frames are all tight on all of this, Madam Chair, but I do think it's not one we should take off the table because, quite honestly, sometimes it's more expensive to modify ancient legacy systems that are very difficult to work with than to start from scratch with something that meets two sets of needs and is really seamless in its interface. So I think we should continue to explore that possibility.
Madam Chair, Representative Laughlin, I think it's also important for us to keep in mind that our legacy systems do other things other than health care. MMIS in itself is essentially a payment system, and Maxis is doing child care assistance, cash, food support, so we have to kind of look at how is it that if we were going to, what happens to all those other programs that are embedded in those systems as well.
Thank you, Ms. Loeffler. I would like to add my own opinion that it seems our legacy systems and some of the policy and probably the disinvestment that we've seen in the state in the past number of years has really left us in this position repeatedly across state government where we aren't able to move forward with something that might make common sense because the hill is too hard to climb. So I want to echo what Representative Loeffler is saying, that I think we need to push ourselves, and this is not directed to you, Mr. Magnin, or Ms. Gibson, but as policymakers and leaders of the state, to think about what is going to be in the best interest of the future of Minnesota, rather than continuing to take what appears to be a short-term Band-Aid approach to the systems that support the important work that people are doing in the state of Minnesota. Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Magnin. I see on your chart that the online application is under development, and when I was last part of a group, the discussion was going on about whether that online application, an applicant would be able to sign with an electronic verification, sign electronically, and I'm wondering where is that discussion at, and could you?
Madam Chair, member, yes, we have not forgotten the electronic signature issue. Actually, we are still working on, we believe that we have an authentication functionality in place that will allow us to be able to have user IDs and passwords and then allow people to log into the online application and to be able to use the electronic signature, which will satisfy even a very narrow interpretation of what CMS is asking and actually satisfies DHS policy about electronic signatures at the same time. So I'm optimistic that we will have an electronic signature in place on July 1st when we roll this out statewide.
Ms. O'Connell.
And is that being developed with the new changes in mind that are going to have to be placed in 2014? Are you now the process you talk about, that you're describing, is it being because it's going to come up in July, are you now thinking about how easy will this be to convert this for what we will need in 2014?
Mr. Magnin.
Madam Chair, member, no. I mean, not being glib, but I think we're really concentrating on trying to get out the product that we need this day. I believe that much of the capacity in this online application that we're developing could be a springboard for the online application the website application is required for the exchange, but we have so little detail, and it's very clear in the legislative language that the secretary is going to dictate the form of the application. So we're really trying to concentrate on what we have now, and we locked down our business requirements on this months ago in terms of saying this is what we need for this. And I don't mean that to sound like I'm being short-sighted, but it is just in terms of the scope of what we're trying to do for a limited amount of resources in the projects. We have to focus on what we know now.
Ms. O'Connell.
Just to follow up then on the electronic signature so will a person be able to sign it and send it to DHS under this new application, or will they have to download and sign and send?
Madam Chair, member, it would be an electronic signature in which they would sign that, and that would be submission, and we would not require a paper signature.
Mr. Cathal?
Yes, recognizing the importance of a decision related to a legacy system versus a new system, is it within the scope or the charge of this committee to make recommendations or to at least get an assessment of the cost of sticking with a legacy system and tweaking it versus creating a new system?
Mr. Cathal, I think that we could make a recommendation if we chose to. This is an issue that we have been wrestling with in the legislature for a number of years, and numbers of us have been to see, assess, have worked to try and understand the work that the legacy systems are doing and their shortcomings as we move forward. So I think we could do that, but I think the shortcomings are probably fairly well known. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I also think that it would be difficult to assess the cost without having a few more details about what the system has to be able to do. So I think at some point it would be good to make that assessment, but I think it would be premature at this point in time.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I agree we do need more details, but it seems like now is the time to do it once the details are available, rather than just marching forward with a legacy system if it doesn't work.
Ms. Blewett?
My understanding is, Madam Chair, in other states that are developing these interfaces to do the eligibility online enrollment, and then it communicates with the legacy system. So they're trying to develop that flexibility into their online enrollment so they can adapt it to the new rules once there. So I would encourage the department to think about adaptability as opposed to kind of locking in but having flexibility. And I know that there's at least, I don't know, five states that are pursuing a contract with Deloitte to do that, similar to what's being done in Wisconsin. But the idea is to embed the flexibility so you're not locked in and have to do another whole system, but that it's flexible enough to move.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, a question, Mr. Mangan. This eligibility piece, particularly with the state programs, do you envision that it will be, you know, a wizard of sorts that starts to ask questions and then points the individual towards the appropriate program they belong in? Will it be connected in that way or not?
Madam Chair, member, the online application that we're developing right now is smart but not too smart. We've built rules into that. For example, if I say I'm a male, it doesn't ask me if I'm pregnant. There's some logic built in there, but not to the point of getting to an eligibility determination. We're going to try to make sure that the application asks the individual the questions that are needed based on their sort of initial demographic responses and what programs they're applying for, because the application is actually for healthcare, cash, food support, child care assistance, since the basic questions you're asking for all of those are fairly similar, but there are some variations. So it's smart to the extent of guiding someone through to make sure that we're getting the answers to the questions that we need, but to move to the level of getting towards a more of an eligibility determination is kind of a whole different level of functionality and something that I think based on some of our previous experience with online applications, we were eager to avoid at this point. And given the level of funding we had, it made more sense for us to get an application out there that's really usable for folks. It does have a rules engine built into it, but not to the extent where we're going to get down to that kind of making an eligibility determination.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mangan, since you put some smart technology into it, does any of it help with the processing of the application and reduce the amount of manual overrides that people have to do with the current legacy systems?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think our intent in that is to more than anything, to make the experience for the applicant as easy as possible about knowing which questions they need to answer and being able to get just the information that's needed from them in terms of making what this can be sort of a confusing application form simpler by presenting it in that way. I think that the end product may be easier for folks to on the county or Minnesota Care Operations end to enter because the output is going to be a little bit more standardized. There won't be these attachments if there's multiple dependents and some of that. But in terms of making a better processing, making the processing go more smoothly, I'm not sure. I think we will see once. But that was not necessarily the intent. The intent was to get a clean set of information, easily get that easily to the applicant and get that into the hands of the worker and present it in as you know, sort of clean way as possible. I think it'll be easier for them to work with the online application than it is the forms in general, but whether it will lead to some of the things that you were talking about, I don't know.
And Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mangan, I have kind of a follow-up question to my earlier question. Your slide earlier says that I'm not familiar with the details of the rules, but it says that there shall be a website that enrolls, helps someone determine eligibility and enrolls the individual in the program. So how does the website do that? I mean, it sounds like the thought process is we're going to gather information through a website, but then bring an individual into the process to make the eligibility or enrollment decision. So how's the website? I guess unless it's just semantics are different, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm clear about what we're supposed to do.
Madam Chair, member, yes, I think when you read that language, it says the website will enroll. It does sort of give it a little bit of a, you know, like a machine is doing all that. I think that in many cases, most cases, there probably is going to be human intervention involved in those. So to me, it's more of a semantic difference. I don't see that we're at the point, not in 3 years, where we're going to be having that kind of level of where it's eligibility is proceeding without human intervention, which that sort of implies. But that's my interpretation of that. I don't think we've got anything further about what that actually means.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mangan, are you looking at doing an online information gathering to determine eligibility for elderly, disabled, and families with children or individuals, or only the latter two groups?
Mr. Mangan.
Madam Chair, or Senator Berglund, the online application that we're working on right now has the MALTC application built into that. So we will be doing that, at least you can apply for MA long-term care through the online application.
Madam Chair, Senator Mr. Mangan, if I might say so, I think that's part of your problem. I can see where we wouldn't be ready in 3 years to do all of that you're trying to do. And I can see how it would compromise the eligibility system that would be needed under federal law for the exchange. But I don't think it's necessary to be doing all of that at this time.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think when we were looking at the functionality that we needed for doing MA or Minnesota Care, the amount of questions that we needed to add on there to be able to allow the application to also do long-term care was not really much of a much additional work for us to be able to offer that functionality. And again, what you're doing is you're ending up with the information that you would get if you had someone fill out the MA long-term care application and fax it into the county or hand it into the county. That's just what the online application will do, is just to gather the information that you would get on the paper form. And certainly in long-term care, there's going to be even more extensive human intervention in terms of that application. But it's really just to duplicate what you would have done if you had filled out the paper form. So I don't think it's not something that we're still planning to roll it out in July of 2011, and I don't think it's something that's going to hinder any steps that we take over the next several years for us to be able to, if we need to adapt this to meet the requirements under the ACA. It's not a major piece of the application.
Ms. O'Connell?
Madam Chair, Mr. Mangan, I find myself sitting here being somewhat distressed, knowing that our state right next door to us seems to have online real-time application capability. So it's out there, and it seems like if other states have figured it out, why in 3 years, what is unique about our state that in 3 years' time we could not be there, which is what your testimony is seeming to suggest.
Mr. Mangan.
Madam Chair, member, I'm not sure I'm following you. I don't know what I'm saying is that we have an application that with the generosity of the legislature and the $500,000 for an online application, we're in the process of developing an online application to that will serve as a substitute for the paper application process for those individuals who choose to apply. That will be rolling out in July of 2011. Where we go from there, I mean, certainly Wisconsin's model was something that we modeled after. They had a lot more money in terms of being able to interface with their existing legacy systems, and they chose to go that route. Where we choose to move the online application after this initial development is certainly something that, you know, as a department, the legislature, other folks will have a say in. But from my perspective, I don't see how we're limiting ourselves going forward with what we've done up till now. I'm not following.
I don't, O'Connell. Madam Chair, Mr. Magnin, I wasn't suggesting, you made the comment that you, or I thought maybe I misinterpreted your comment that you thought it was going to be difficult to get to the point where we did not have a human determining eligibility. And that's what I was reacting to, because it seems to me that we have other states where there is not a human determining eligibility, and that they actually do have systems that do the actual determining of eligibility. And it seems like that doesn't seem like an insurmountable hill to get up between now and 2014. So I'm just wondering what I'm missing.
Madam Chair, member, I don't believe that that's how the Wisconsin system works, but I may be wrong. I'm not an expert in how their system. I think that there's still that information from the application is going into their mainframe system, but workers are still intervening to ensure that verifications match with what information the person has presented on their application. But again, I'm not an expert on that system, and we can certainly discuss that some other time. But I don't believe that that's how it works. But I've been wrong before, so.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Department of Human Services. My understanding is that Wisconsin and several other states have used federal funds to actually create their new computer systems, and that as a result, other states can get that federally funded software to modify to fit their state. And I think one of the things we need to look at is what would be the disadvantages of converting to another state system, what modifications would be needed to keep to the existing Minnesota rules, and whether or not we might be able to more quickly move ahead by not starting from where we have been, but actually trying to see if we could cost-effectively adopt a system that the programming's already been field-tested and put out there.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just comment, I just think it would be of great value, and maybe this has happened and we just haven't talked about it, but of great value to sort of begin with the end in mind, to say where is it that we need to go and what should it look like when it's done, and then, you know, sort of cost that out and schedule that out in some sort of broad plan that says, we have funding to go so far, but this is where we think we're headed in the end, and we're going to explore all these options. I see pieces adding on to an old system, and I think that's what some of these comments are saying too. Pieces added on to an old system rather than saying, doesn't matter what system we use, we have to get to a certain point. We should be able to be at least enroll some of our folks, a percentage of them, you know, without human intervention. I think that's possible. It's not going to be 100%, never will be. There should be some support person to help if someone gets stuck, and then individuals who are just not capable, that's also always going to be needed. But putting all that into the vision of where this goes, I mean, there's so much money, I think, involved in doing this, not in building it, in how we do it today, that it's well worth our time to build that plan and then head us in that direction.
And if you will, members, I think that we should probably think about moving on with the presentation. It is November the 8th, so quickly, I think now quickly, as a group, we're going to have to come up with our recommendations, which have the end in mind for the administration going forward. But first, we have to get through the rest of this, and there was just one more point I wanted to make before you proceeded, and that was to the early point about the possibility of someone being eligible for both Medicaid and the exchange. And I know this is a really complex piece of legislation that was passed by the Congress, and I know when I used to lobby, you know, when something big passed, we'd go through and mark up all the possible iterations of what could happen, sort of walking through all of those iterations. And it's complex, but I am fairly certain in the end we will get advice that will disallow someone being eligible for a subsidy and eligible for Medicaid at the same time. So I just think that we need, from my perspective as a policymaker, to put that on the record, that it might look like that in the law, but I don't expect that we'll get there. If you could proceed, please, that would be great.
Moving on to slide 28, this is a list of forms and processes for certain populations that we don't expect to change in 2014 in Iowa. A variety of family planning, MABC, and other programs that we do not believe will be affected by the ACA. Another piece of the application enrollment is the ongoing case maintenance. We think that pretty much most of these are going to be are needed now and are going to be needed in the future. The six-month and annual eligibility reviews, acting on changes in eligibility, things like income, household size, assets are things that are frequently reported to counties and may impact eligibility or premiums. Right now, county workers and Minnesota Care Operations folks participate in appeals hearings when someone's appealing a DHS agency decision. They need to cooperate with the audit process and implement corrective actions that come out of those audit processes, often through our division. County workers are involved in the assessment and collection of overpayments, involved in program integrity activities. These are things that are activities around planning, preparing, and executing fraud prevention, doing investigations, doing prosecutions. County workers have to, Minnesota Care Operations workers are involved in those. Providing for access services, as we discussed previously, both sort of interpretation services, but other things like services that are needed to assist folks to access the medical services, that's transportation, lodging, meals, interpreters. Those are the things that county workers and Minnesota Care Operations folks are involved in. And then finally, transferring and receiving case information between processing entities as our folks move, which our population does tend to be a bit more mobile, or move between MA and Minnesota Care. We have to move information between those entities. We put unknown under 2014 just because we're not really sure about some of those lines of responsibility between, again, sort of maybe who the entities are that are doing the exchange eligibility and the Medicaid CHIP eligibility, and we're not sure if the exchange responsibility for Medicaid or CHIP eligibility determinations will be limited to the Magi populations or not. But this is the scope of activities that are going to have to occur under any structure. Federal vision for the exchange and Medicaid interaction. Individuals who are seeking coverage should have the same experience whether they're subsidy eligible and or not, or whether they apply through Medicaid or through the exchange. This is the idea of one application process. I only have to provide my information once. Again, for most people, eligibility enrollment should happen in real time. Some people may have discrepancies between what they report and what we verify when we look at their income, their family status. For those individuals, it's still an expectation of timely response, but maybe not, you know, real time in terms of that day. And other individuals that may have more specific determination, like disability, may require more information and processing time. We saw a longer processing time for folks on MA who are have a disability because of some of those issues. HHS is developing a federal interface connection for verification from federal agencies such as IRS. IRS is really important in this just because of the Magi requirement, being able to look at tax returns. That's not something we routinely look at right now. In Minnesota Care Operations, we do request tax returns for folks who are self-employed because that's one of the best ways to get income information from them. But it's not something we're routinely getting directly from the IRS, and that's certainly something that will need to be done for operating the exchange, also because of the tax credits issue. We do have a 90% matching rate for Medicaid eligibility systems until the end of 2015. 75% match for this for the maintenance after 2015. Obviously, to receive those funds, the system has to be able to work with the exchange, and that's been a theme throughout this in terms of connection between those. And startup funding for the exchange IT is fully federally funded. Some of the interaction considerations. Exchange enrollment and Medicaid CHIP enrollment is a little bit different in how it's structured. Under the exchange, there's an annual open enrollment eligibility for most people, determined annually based on whatever electronic information we have. There's special enrollment eligibility. If you have a change in circumstance, it may move you into a different level of coverage, or may move you from Medicaid into the exchange. So there does have to be a sort of ongoing special enrollment. As we've discussed before, the exchange determination of Medicaid and CHIP eligibility has to be transmitted to the Medicaid agency, and the Medicaid agency determination of MA or CHIP ineligibility has to be transmitted back to the exchange. This is, of course, a little bit different than how we operate Medicaid CHIP enrollment. We don't have an open enrollment period. I mean, we have continuous enrollment. You can apply it at any time for Medicaid or CHIP, so a big difference there. But individuals enrolled in qualified plans under the exchange may apply for Medicaid and CHIP at any time. Again, it's an open enrollment process. And as we've talked about before, we're doing within MA Minnesota Care, we're doing ongoing eligibility redeterminations anytime a change in circumstance is reported where somebody's income goes down. We're looking at, for example, redetermining their premium under Minnesota Care. So that's a continuous ongoing process. And that includes MA, MA-LTC, MA with a spend down. So a difference there between MA and the exchange. In terms of systems, automation, and interface, data provided through the application will need to interface with all eligibility systems. This is, again, this idea of just needing to ask for the information once from someone and be able to run out the eligibility determinations that need to be made based on that, not having to go back to folks unless we're getting into verifications issues. Electronic verification system will need to be available across all eligibility systems so that we can do verification of income, social security number, citizenship, and immigration status. If we need to do assets for certain populations, although probably not within this group, that we can do that uniformly and quickly and be able to access the electronic data sources that we have available to us now or will in the future. And I think this last bullet is more of a best practice, but just making sure that as we look at automation for the exchange and for whatever changes need to be made to healthcare eligibility going forward, remember that some people who are exchange eligible may also be eligible for financial assistance programs, such, cash, food support, child care assistance. Just remembering that we're not just focusing on health care with folks. We're trying to look at the full set of their needs across possible programs. We've said this a number of times. We must have secure electronic interface. When we start getting into this, if there is this possibility of folks being enrolled in both the exchange and Medicaid and CHIP, which may or may not be likely, we may need more and different interfaces than we have now in terms of being able to manage that coverage. As I mentioned earlier, at a minimum, there will be systems changes to our systems. I mean, if we continue with Maxis MMIS in their form right now as the way that we're going to continue to determine eligibility and make payments for public populations, we're going to need to make system changes just based on the changes like Magi and other things to our public programs. There's already a lot of changes there just from that aspect. And if we decide that we want to have one system that does both exchange and public program eligibility, obviously that means a lot more changes to be ready for 2014.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Blewett.
It's so am I understanding that the online enrollment you're developing for implementation this July is not the exchange, or it's not going to be the exchange eligibility enrollment system?
No, what we're doing, the online application that we're developing now is a way to gather the information that someone would have put on a paper application for whatever programs they're choosing to apply for, and then deliver that to the county. But again, make that process of filling out the application easier.
And then, Madam Chair, Mr. Morgan, has the decision been made about who in the state is going to develop the exchange enrollment and eligibility system?
Madam Chair, member, that's the work of this group and others. It's not, you know, as we've been involved in the analysis of ACA and presenting the information, but that is not our decision, not DHS's decision.
Thank you.
All right, I just wanted to hit on a few in case you haven't had enough of the online application, which I think we all have. So I've said all this before, and I will skip by this quickly. I'm actually the project sponsor for that. The project manager for that particular project works for me. So, you know, if there's further questions after this, please, I'm happy to talk about them. Electronic verification, you know, we noted in one of the previous slides that this is a important part of the exchange moving forward, and it's something that we're working on now just within the management of our public programs eligibility. It's very important, not just in health care, but cash, food support, child care assistance, child support. We've chartered through the Enterprise Architecture Office a electronics verification project, the goal of which is to develop an electronic verification system that will allow us to support eligibility across a variety of programs and will connect with existing data sources that we have within state government and within the federal government that we're already using to verify things that I mentioned before, income, assets, citizenship, identity. We're also working on trying to clarify our data sharing agreements with those other state agencies that share data with us now. We've gathered the business requirements. We're working on technical requirements. We're hoping to be able to move towards some implementation by the fall of 2011, but as you may understand, it's a big project. The goal of this is to have a tool that all financial assistance workers at the counties and Minnesota Care Operations can use as a sort of one-stop shop for getting essentially instantaneous verification data on a client. They're looking at an application. They have a Social Security number. They enter that into the system, and it brings back income, asset, all of those other, you know, vehicle ownership, all the things that based on the best existing data that we have. Obviously, a long way to go on this project, and even fall of 2011 is probably a little optimistic, but we're working hard on that.
Mr. Magnin, can you just, and I can tell you're so ready to be done. but if you could just drill down a little further into the development of the data sharing agreements among the agencies, I think I heard you say you're working to make sure they're set, the ones that we think are already in place,
Madam Chair,
they're functioning. So
we actually have, for example, with one source of data that number of people in the department use is the deed quarterly wage data, which they collect for their own reasons, but is very useful for us for verifying income for folks, even though it's a little bit out of date. But we probably have three or four different entities within the Department of Human Services who are using that data and have data sharing agreements. So we're just trying to consolidate that, make sure that we have one data sharing agreement that will also be robust enough for a much broader application, because some of these data sharing agreements are for example, the operation of our auditing group or for smaller programs. So we want to make sure, one, that we just have one, because it doesn't make sense for us to have multiple ones from my perspective, but also that we then have the necessary authority for doing something that's on this bigger of a scale, because this certainly presents issues to deed, for example. If we're going to use that data on a much larger scale for potentially hundreds of thousands of people throughout the year, that's a little bit different thing in terms of using their data, how much we take, all those sorts of things. So we're trying to go down the line for all of the data that we currently use in some very limited functions. We get information from DPS for some of our folks who do so the fraud investigators or do some other like MEQC or PERM where they're looking at the performance of county and Minnesota Care Operations financial workers. They do that on a very limited basis. If we want to, again, use that across potentially a couple thousand financial workers and Minnesota care workers, we want to make sure that those agreements are sort of solid and get what we need, and that we are clear about the breadth of those agreements with those agencies. So it's more a lot of just sitting down with people and talking and making sure we're on the same page and understanding who the contacts are. And I think so far the other agencies have been receptive because carrying multiple data sharing agreements with us is not something they want or are necessarily interested in doing. And so this has some enterprise implications, too, in terms of just how we as state agencies all work together on some of this data sharing, because a lot of that goes around. So.
Thank you.
And another thing that we're doing, and all of these initiatives are things that I think are providing us with a foundation for exchange implementation, but are also things that we just need for our operations right now. If there wasn't any federal reform on the horizon, these are all things that we would be doing because they're needed to help us better process the cases that the counties and Minnesota Care Operations work with. We're looking at a customer contact center in terms of trying to consolidating our resources around eligibility-related questions that we get from clients, applicants, counties, tribes, community organizations, providers. We get lots of questions about eligibility, about assisting people with eligibility. So we're just working across HCEA, which includes Minnesota Care Operations, to try to have a new approach to that that, again, may serve as a springboard or a model for some of the things under the ACA. There are certainly a number of, probably a lot more than just these bullet points in terms of potential unknowns around processing and systems, but I think, as Ms. Gibson may have mentioned earlier, will the Medicaid Magi differ from the Exchange Magi? That has some huge implications for how we process and how many times we have to process through someone as we're looking at their income. Will different eligibility rules apply to Magi populations when there's a need for nursing home care? A potentially big issue. And as I think I mentioned earlier, under the unknowns on one of the processing slides, will the exchange responsibility for Medicaid and CHIP determinations be limited to Magi populations? Will they be required to do all of them? Again, that's sort of that structure of what is the Medicaid CHIP eligibility piece and what is the exchange piece and where do those reside? And we couldn't have a presentation without finishing up with some opportunities and challenges. So I think there is some ability to align and simplify programs. We've talked about having Magi as more of a uniform income standard is going to be beneficial to us in terms of processing. Unfortunately, it's not across every case, so we're going to have to apply different income standards. We hope that there's an opportunity to improve the client experience. Online application, we hope, is one piece of that. The website and being able to empower people by giving them some ability to make some decisions about their health care. We hope that there's the opportunity to leverage some of this technology funding to improve our eligibility systems as well as the exchange. I think if that will be a big opportunity lost if we're not able to do that. Probably the big challenge here when we start talking about systems development, those sorts of things, they haven't issued guidance on those Medicaid changes, much less some of the exchange things, effective basically in 3 years. And that is a huge challenge.
Ms. Blewett?
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Morgan. I'm interested in this question. Will the Medicaid Magi be different from the exchange? I thought the whole point was that they were going to use a common eligibility and what you're thinking where there might be differences.
Madam Ms. Chair,
Gibson?
Member, there was an earlier slide, I think, in my portion of the presentation where right now the IRS code doesn't really match up with Medicaid rules. And so I think that's sort of the rub around this is some of those pieces. The way we defined household is somewhat different than the way the IRS does. The way that we count certain kinds of income in some instances is a little bit different. And, of course, our point of reference for the Medicaid program is a determination of current eligibility going forward, trying to get income information, for example, which is current and kind of anticipate what it will be for the future, as opposed to using a tax return which might have wage data that's, up to a year or more old. So some of that has to be reconciled, and I just don't think it has been completely figured out yet.
Thank you.
Ms. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think there's some other opportunities here, and they're yet to be sort of figured out. And there's also some pitfalls, I guess. But, I mean, in our eligibility systems for public programs, we really emphasize a ton of information about who do you live with and how are you related and who's the father of which child, and lots of information about every little piece of financial data in your life, including what cars you own. And in the private sector, which is also going to be part of the exchange, it's more about your health status and what experiences happened to you when and who was the treating person. And they don't really care a whole lot about how much child support you get and who owes it. And for that customer experience, to have to share absolutely everything on both sides of that ledger is going to be a potential challenge to get the patience of the public, as even if they see opportunities for insurance and coverage that's more affordable to them than is currently the case. And I think that's going to be a challenge to all of us on both sides of the private and the public sector to figure out how to work that out. I think it's also going to mean, though, some real opportunities on the public side, because right now we just enroll people if they're financially eligible, and we don't really ask much about their health status unless they're pregnant, because that's a special category of eligibility. And we might be able to get more sophisticated in our purchasing and in our deciding on payments to providers. You know, we might be able to categorize people by something other than just age and sex, but really know something about their health status. I know the Wisconsin system has a health assessment built into their system that they can use in a variety of different ways. And so I think we need to start thinking more broadly about, with additional information, what would that advantage us to do? And I think on both sides, on the public and the private insurance side, we're going to have to think about what do we really minimally need? Because I think the tolerance of the public that is most likely to use the exchange to try and figure out insurance may be that they're not going to spend, I mean, there's libraries that limit people to a half hour on the computer, and you wouldn't be able to do it in a half hour, even if you had good typing skills. So I think we're going to have to kind of figure this one out as we go along, but I think both sides need to kind of figure out what's the minimum we really need.
Ms. O'Connell?
Madam Chair, Ms. Gibson, one of the problems or one of the areas that the department has historically talked about is a problem for Minnesota care processing has been the self-employment issue, people that are self-employed. And so do you see that the Magi will really address that issue of the complexity of the current Minnesota care rules regarding self-employment or help with the processing?
Madam Chair, member, yes, I think that will help to some extent, except in the case where the person, at least the way Medicaid operates today, if someone claims the tax return isn't reflective of my current self-employment situation.
Right, the exception.
Then we would ask, you know, for business records or some other source of verification for that.
Ms. O'Connell.
On a little different note, looking at your presentation, you mentioned about this category of people that are MA for payment of long-term care services. So I'm a little confused there. That isn't a basis of eligibility currently, right? I mean, you're elderly or you're disabled, and you get long-term care services. So who are you referring to there?
Madam Chair, remember that's correct. Usually, I think most often we think of those services with regard to someone who's elderly or a person with a disability. However, a parent could be in need of those services as well. So there's just an additional layer, I hate to say, there's an additional layer of rules. Mostly, I think for the most part, coming out of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, that got applied to long-term care services around home equity limits, you know, annuities and some other items.
But wouldn't, I mean, wouldn't it's not really, it doesn't really change under Magi, though. I mean, change under the new system, right? I mean, this payment for long-term care services. I mean, that person today faces the same issue if I'm a parent about how I can get long-term care services, right?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Gibson.
That is correct. But we aren't clear and haven't been able to get clarification from the federal agency of if there would be any change for the Magi populations with regard to their need for long-term care services. And do we just still compute that the same way that it's done today?
Mr. DiTillo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gibson, the new definition under the ACA is basically based off of income. The asset test is gone, I take it, correct?
Madam Chair, member, that's correct.
Okay. Where was the challenges that you currently have with assets, to verify assets? Is that a greater challenge or is that a lesser challenge than verifying income?
Ms. Gibson.
Madam Chair, member, actually, I think it's been a lesser challenge to verify assets for what I think is our Magi population than income has been. Oftentimes, I think one of the biggest delays in processing an application has been around income and providing the income verification, be it the pay stubs that maybe weren't retained by the person and that kind of a thing, and then needing to get a release signed by them so that their employer could be contacted to verify. So I think for the Magi populations, generally, it's been more on the income side.
Mr. DiTillo. Yep.
One more question. The definition of incomes going from gross to net, is there any type of study that, so we know how many more are now going to qualify, because that's more positive, people with greater, income is actually going to now qualify, correct?
Ms. Gibson.
Madam Chair, member, yes, there should be more people that will be qualifying. I don't know that an analysis has been done as to what the numbers are around that yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Members of the working group, are there other questions? Well, I would like to thank both of you for your presentation today. And, you know, it's been almost 2 hours worth of a grill-a-thon, which is, you know, nice work on your parts, but it's important information for us, and we really appreciate it. Thank you very much. And with that, I think we'll adjourn the meeting for today, and we will see each other again on the 16th.
A little. I got some initial feedback. It's trying to take theirs and make it a little more understandable, I think, was what my attempt is, not as detailed as theirs. Mine is, and so this has been geared towards a higher level. People that are even less self than maybe what's in this room, familiar with the Medicare and the benefit kind of issues.
It's to link to that?
Because I think it's still, this whole piece of the base, but
it's like, there's a